So, it is time for the Lean Into Art Cast, the show where two visual storytellers get together to wrestle, wrangle, and otherwise wrap their brains around some potentially difficult topics. I hope they're difficult. I like a challenge. How about you, Rob Stenzinger?
Hey, Jersey Drozd. I noticed that all my challenges are definitely scaled to my abilities. So,
what does that mean?
No, I don't know. I mean, I sometimes think, yeah, this is pretty good. Then I look over and I see someone doing way better, and that's that's all right.
Oh,
because I'm doing what I can.
Is that curveball? Are we starting with curveball? With there's always a bigger fish. How do you deal with that, Rob? How do you deal with there's always a bigger fish? Do you put your head in the sand and, oh shucks, I don't even want to try anymore?
Oh, it. This is the easiest curveball you've ever lobbed at me. I'm far more at ease if there's a lot of bigger fish around me, where I have a chance to just see things from fresh perspectives for people who are doing interesting work that I respect, and hopefully they're approachable. That way I can then, since we're talking about a metaphor that theoretically I can become a big fish. I don't have to physically transform. I just have to learn what they learn and gain from their experience to get my own experience. And then, you know, hopefully I'm, you know, becoming a bigger fish over time.
Is this something that was innate in you, or is it something where you had to learn this kind of like through the school of hard knocks? I mean, because, like, you know, a lot of people I've known in my life, their response to seeing excellence is envy and not to be inspired. Maybe I'm speaking for myself. Maybe I'm not. I'm not going to say. But, you know, it's like I can say that at least here and now today, when I see somebody do something awesome, it usually inspires me to try to take my stuff to the next level, to be that, to learn from that awesomeness, right? Mm-hmm. Watching somebody do something really, really well is usually pretty electrifying. But not everybody responds that way, right?
Yeah, I think it has to do with, do you see that resource as being uniquely possessable and scarce? For me, I see it as that's something that I could not in all cases. I obviously, I don't think I can attain every single thing what everyone does. I also have the annoying inverse quirk where I feel that pretty much everyone can do what I can do if they, you know, given the right situation and, you know, practice or need to do that. Yeah, I mean, I try to be open-minded on both sides of that. Not overly possessive or overly, you know, fearful that I can't, gain a certain capability. But honestly, it's more like I end up finding limits. I mean, I'm trying to think of a good situation to stop talking to generalities. I've noticed in job situations where some people are able to keep track of an insane amount of things all at once. And and this isn't always great in my opinion, where even if the seeing the skill happening kind of amazes me, but I've seen people in situations where they could be in a meeting, hear and understand what's going on around them, and because a deadline looms or what have you, be working on a design or something, a document of one sort or another, sometimes visual, sometimes prose or what have you. And they're able to answer and be present in the meeting, make progress on that thing, and even maybe send that thing off. And I'll just be like, oh, okay, I'm just barely paying, you know, being able to totally get what's going on. And I still don't think I do. And I'm just paying attention to the meeting, right? And so, sometimes I'll think, oh gosh, that would I? So I'll see an incredible talent, and I'll think, you know, do I want that talent? What would I try to do to be able to perform in that way? That
or
kind of thing,
or even in a non-vampiric sense, vampiric sense. I don't know how to pronounce
it. I suppose. I am. It's pretty much how can I take that person's soul?
How can I eat their flesh and take their strength into my own?
Exactly.
But even in not in that sense. I mean, because I totally do that, you know. But it is also something about seeing somebody do something really, really well. That's just a pleasure to watch. I mean, like, why do people watch sports? Right? It's like you watch sports because you like watching people do something excellent. Why do people watch? Okay, if you're not a sports fan, The Voice or American Idol or any of those shows where somebody does like a talented kind of thing in front of a camera. It's a pleasure to watch somebody do something well, but I don't know. This was not a prepared curveball, so I haven't like formulated my thoughts on like where did this come from in me. But I'll tell you one thing: there is, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, Rob, but perhaps not. There's nothing like being surrounded by people who are smarter than you. It's electrifying, and there's nothing more dreadful than being surrounded by people who you feel like are slowing you down, right? And the sense of envy, like I think the sense of envy is like this, it comes out of this sense of like, I want to be the top dog. I want to be the big fish, and I don't want to have that contestant. I don't want to have to continually fight for that thing. Whereas when you're in a room full of talented and smart people, most of the time, in my experience at any rate, nobody's fighting, nobody's jockeying for that position. Everybody's just trying to like do as good a performance as they can.
Well, it's oftentimes in those situations, you're fighting to do your best instead of fighting to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And
a lot of times, yes.
Yeah, that's when I find myself in the latter situation, I find that really frustrating. I'm trying to think. I do get, you know what? I mean, it's easy to observe someone in a role and or exhibiting a skill and think, oh, look at them have an easier life in one way, shape, or form. Like they're exhibiting some agency or choice or ability or thing that I don't feel like I'm currently able to exercise.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then think, well, oh, that'd be awesome. I wish I could exercise that.
This goes back to a curveball from what, one or two episodes ago, where you were talking about that band that was that you were admiring their expertise as musicians, but you were repelled by the messages of their songs and the cognitive dissonance that comes out of seeing somebody do something very, very well that you disagree with, right?
Sure.
Anyway, yep. I don't know if we got to the top or bottom of that curveball, but it was an interesting thought that you threw out. And I wanted to jump on it. It was better than the one I had. So, hey, you know what? I wanted to open up the curveball to the public. And anybody who wants to weigh in on this thought, if you think that Jersey was wrong, and I know why, you can email us at leanintoart@gmail.com. Or you can send us an MP3 audio response. We'll play it on the show. We've got the ability to do that now where I can fire off little audio clips during the recording. We'd like you guys to weigh in on these curveballs or give us a curveball of your own. Give us a question. An open-ended question that is without that suggests it does not have a definitive answer, and the objective of this exercise is to make me and Rob go, huh, and make us really chew on it for a second on the air, and maybe we can award points to whoever makes us stop and look at the ceiling long enough.
Yeah, we could. Yeah, we could do our best to officiate it as a little mini game.
All right, so are you ready to kick into main topic then this week, Rob?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, then I think we can do is go 1,000 feet up to talk about how starting can be logical. A reprise, if you will, of our discussion in episode 1, Starting is Hard. And I think, if I remember right, it's been a long time since we've had that discussion. It was over a year ago now. If I remember right, it was pretty much us focusing on the emotions surrounding starting something and like getting over the emotional difficulties of trying to commit yourself to a project and understanding what things are worth committing to and so on. But I had a couple of flashes of inspiration this week that I think I got linked in the outline. Carl Altstetter. Do you follow him on Twitter, Rob? Are you familiar with his work?
He sounds familiar.
Comic Carl, K-O-M-I-C-K-A-R-L
yes, I do.
On the Twitters, yeah.
Yes, I do.
Super, super nice guy. Really talented artist. Been in the business a long time. I wound up getting to hang out with him when I was at when I was in Anaheim this past summer. I had dinner with him. It was super, super fun. But Carl Altstadter posted a process video of a character design that he's doing for this comic slash video game slash transmedia project. And the thing I love about Carl's work is it's really, really dynamic. There's so much energy in his work, and everything just looks ferocious when he draws it. And as a guy who likes to, you know, focus on trying to capture energy in his work, that's something that's very interesting to me. And, but when I was watching that process video, and it's only a couple minutes long, it's like a sped up watching him draw in Photoshop, I was really caught off guard by how many tweaks and edits and how many little things he fixed. Like he would like use the selection tool and grab the character's arm, move it over here, move it over there. Move it. You could see him weighing in his mind. Does it look better here? Does it look better there? Does it look better here? Does it look better there? And I was watching this deliberation happen. It sped up 8 times. And I realized that, wow, you know, when I see really energetic and dynamic art, I didn't realize it until I saw that, until I was caught off guard by this, that I assume that the artist is working with the same ferocious energy on the page that the drawing ultimately has. Like, it's just happening. It's just this visceral thing that comes out of you. I'm going to make the pools awesome. But then when I was watching this guy deliberate on what's more dynamic, it dawned on me. And like I said in the post on Google Plus, is that, you know, in retrospect, it seems obvious that, of course, dynamism can be a calculated and deliberate thing. So that was the first clue into today's topic. The second one came out of the fact that I'm in a lot of meetings. I'm constantly in a lot of meetings as the co-organizer of the Kids Read Comics event. I'm involved with this Captain Seriously project, you know, that I do comics for, and I wind up sitting in a lot of meetings as we develop the project for next year. I just went to a series of meetings for that to plan out the 2013 publishing schedule for the next book. And so I'm in a lot of meetings with a lot of people, and one of the things that came up in one of the meetings was this concept of the logic map, trying to come up with addressing needs, assigning activities, and determining outcomes, which harkens back to, and I swear to God, I'm going to get through this like framing bit in just a second here. It harkens back to my work as a teacher, Rob. I'm wondering if you can weigh in on this, having just taught your first week at MCAD. No, it was at the high school, right?
Yeah, the FAIR program at MCAD.
The FAIR program at MCAD, teaching HTML. Yep. When you're developing a syllabus, you know, often you're asked to define what are the objectives, activities, and outcomes. Objectives, what do you hope will happen in this exercise? Activities, what are the things that you're going to do? And outcomes, how will the students change upon completing this these activities or exercises or whatever you want to call them, right? And so as I'm sitting here in this doing this logic map stuff and going through the same kind of thinking process that I go through when I'm doing lesson plans for my classes, I realize this is exactly the kind of stuff that we're doing when we're starting a new project of any kind of visual storytelling project, be it a comic, be it a presentation, be it a, I'm hoping, Rob, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I'm assuming in developing software, in designing games, you're thinking about all this kind of stuff, right?
Well, I typically just put words into the computer, and then I see things break.
Like this.
It's hard to even be the devil's advocate on that one, or even clown it, because
Rob Stenzinger, everybody, comes from the method acting school of UI, UX design, and programming.
Yeah, exactly.
He has to slap himself in the face and get into the role.
I do. Yeah. I think, you know, well, honestly, if it's really tough when I need to be sort of a, you know, like a Gen Y mother, that's when things get difficult, but, you just got to role play and work through it. So let's see. Yeah. What you're describing is it's very near and dear to a lot of my day-to-day creative process on pretty much everything. And I would say right now I'm in a phase of I'm becoming more and more appreciative of not always being in that mode and trying to work in concert with emotional reactions and emergent improvisational things intertwined with these other measures and focuses that can really help a project. And I took a few notes based on what you were framing up there. It seemed to me like a lot of what you're describing has a having some kind of calculated approach means that you're playing around with an equation or the elements that go into creating a result, where that's the other side of the equation, right? So you're playing around with the parameters to get some, you know, something or in the range of a possible set of acceptable results. And it's just thinking about what that means, especially a lot of times in the day to day. Sometimes I notice I have that arrangement with myself. And so obviously I often have that arrangement when I'm doing work in a consulting context. And I think in either case, you sort of have this purposeful choice where you're willing to give up some agency, saying like, I'm going to limit myself now because I want a certain result, right? And I think, or whether that's you directing yourself in that way, or you are committing to that kind of direction to provide a predictable, acceptable result, or whatever a client is expecting, because you know they're expressing what their expectations are.
Right. Like at one of the meetings I was at recently, to put that like this into a concrete example of what you're talking about, we had to write on this dry erase board, who's our audience, right? And so we write third and fourth graders. And then it was more people were contributing to this dry erase board. The ideas started getting bigger and bigger to like even third and fourth graders from surrounding communities, even the parents of the third and fourth graders, even the school administrators who are going to be participating in this program. They could be a part of our audience because they could be served in these kind of abstract ways. And the team leader, or whatever you want to call him, kind of reined everybody in and said, whoa, guys, these are supposed to be measurable outcomes. Are you going to go around and survey all these different surrounding communities and the administrators and the parents? Or are we going to keep this into a manageable thing where we can measure the response from an intended audience? That's great if we affect some of these other audiences too. But if measurement is our goal, and I've got some thoughts on measurement in a second that I want to get to, if I remember. But, because, man, I'm tired. As I'm sure you are, Rob. if you are looking for a specific outcome that you can measure in some way, and I'm not talking about statistical data necessarily, but if there's something where you can figure out, did I achieve the goal that I wanted to set out on, less is more, right? The more tightly defined your audience is and how tightly defined your outcome is, the better chance you have of nailing it. It's sort of like quantum theory where you can't measure a particle's, it's position and velocity at the same time kind of thing.
Yeah, the Heisenberg uncertainty,
there we go.
Uncertainty principle. It has to do with how measuring the trajectory and or position of a light particle, the act of measuring it affects it. And this is one of those things that if you're in a lot of you're in a situation where you're providing this kind, some kind of service that's creative to yourself or others, it'd be weirder if you're only doing this to yourself and then you're quote the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to yourself. But it might happen.
If you're Rob Stenziger, yes.
I go, whoa. Why am I having meetings with myself on this? The more meetings I throw at this, the more difficult it is to predict my final estimate and how long it's going to take because I'm meeting too much about it. So I've had various friends and coworkers that have noodled on essentially the Heisenberg meeting uncertainty principle. So the more meetings you throw at a project, the harder it is to tell how far along it is.
Well, that I can back up. I've been involved in projects where, yeah, we spend more time discussing the thing than actually doing the thing. I don't know if I drove us off course there. I do want to set up this prefacing point real quick. We're talking to creative people. Presumably creative people listen and watch this show. And so I'm anticipating that people are going to respond with something along the lines of this. And there's a quote from Joseph Campbell that I think of a lot, you know, and predictably anyone continually knitting their life into context of intention, import, and clarifications of meaning will in the end find that he has lost the sense of experiencing life, right? Mm-hmm. If we spend all our time discussing these things and defining these things and categorizing all these things, we're not actually doing anything with the things or experiencing those things. And sometimes, as you pointed out earlier, Rob, it's nice to break away and just get in touch with that visceral sense of you know, spontaneity and improvisation. And in a past episode, Ryan Estrada was in the chat and he was saying, like, you know, it's fun to listen to Jersey overthink stuff. Yes, I do overthink stuff quite a bit sometimes. And then other times I really, really enjoy improvising and not sticking to any kind of, you know, when I go on trips, I don't work out an itinerary or anything like that. But yeah, so that's an excellent counterpoint to this. So this is my submission to the discussion as we dive into it, is that this is a strategy for thinking about stuff. This is for when you get stuck. This is for when you don't know where to start, where you have too many ideas and you need to start drilling down and whittling down, and your gut reaction isn't helping you because your gut reaction says, all three projects are great. How do I pick it, right? Sometimes the gut isn't much help in that situation, and that's where I defer to these kinds of logical thinking exercises. You know, when I did the Captain Cat mini comic, I didn't sit down and do a logic model. I just said,
you didn't do like a target market, demographic analysis of the product, and you know where the need was in the market, and your strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats analysis.
No, I did not do that. I sat down and I said, I was talking with Ann, and one of us said, Captain Cat, former shark hunter. And that had such a catch to it that I knew it had legs. I knew that there was something there, that even if there wasn't much there, there was enough to get an audience to go, I got to read that, right? Mm-hmm. That's where gut works. But it wasn't a situation where it's like, I've got 10 different ideas for a story about my cat. Which one do I do? How do I figure out which one? They all sound great, right? Which is a peril of being a creative person, is that you come up with so many ideas, you don't know where to begin sometimes, right? So that's all I'm saying.
Honestly, I think that it's a couple things to add to that, an observation to add to your statement about the Captain Cat. So these kinds of strategies help not just on solo projects. They help when you are actually being asked to do things for clients, whether it's any kind of illustration, web development, software, writing, whatever. Get the project into a tangible, known state so you know if you've accomplished something or not. That's beneficial no matter who you're doing it for. Mm-hmm. Back to our design series, we talked about how do you hone your sense of design and you develop your heuristics. And that's where I think having gut reactions is ridiculously powerful, because I think that's when you're giving up control to have more control, because you're just trusting yourself. And you know that when your taste has your skills and applying them, and you've made comics and you've finished a lot of projects, and you've brought them to audiences, and you've honed and experienced a lot of things. And I would argue, like, that gut reaction where it just goes awesome, yeah, to a given concept, I bet that's at least partially informed by your experience and the heuristics you've developed out of making things.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. Oh, and then one final thing that I'll throw as an amendment to that is these are not only good for working with clients, but this helps with developing information that a potential publisher would be interested in. I'm in the process of ironing out a project where I have representation, and thank goodness that I have this representation, because he's giving me the information I need to, or giving me the proper questions I need to address in order to make this pitch packet palatable to publishers. And I used a lot of P's there, and that was not intentional.
pitched packet palatable to publishers. That's the Jersey. That's the four P's of the Jersey system.
Where is Peter Piper? He's in Portland pressing pants. That was a Sesame Street routine. But you know, the publisher wants to know, who's the audience? Who's this for? Where do I shelve this thing? Right? What's the general theme that's being addressed here? Is this part of a series or is this not part of a series? Is this a single one shot? If it's part of a series, is sequential order important to know? You know, is this like Harry Potter where there's books one through however many? Or is it like the Boxcar Kids where you can read any particular one out of order and it doesn't matter, right? So identifying identifying your audience and identifying your objectives and outcomes actually can be very, very useful to you. So let's just get into it then. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I want to talk about, your work in software development, Rob, and UI, UX design. And I want to hear about your teaching experience. Did you do this kind of stuff when you were developing your syllabus for your new class?
Let's see.
Here's where I called Rob out as a fraud.
Totally. I basically read from a marker that I, you know, wrote up and down my arm. Things that I found on, W3Schools.com. Not that that's a bad site, whatever. I've actually learned a ton from that site, what have you. I don't have an arm big enough nor a marker small enough to put all the good information that they have on my arm. Anyway, I went through, my process is often scenario based and I like to think of what kind of change do I want to have happen and what does that look like as it flows over time?
So that's thinking outcome.
Yeah, exactly. So, and to be able to, and the change over time or the progression is like a path through some set of circumstance to get to that outcome. And so then I'll work through this from various user perspectives. For instance, the students thinking, well, what if I care a lot about coding? Or what if I care a lot about the design thinking? Or what if I care a lot about the visual expression of design? And how do I, am I gaining benefit from this experience? So I started to, I went through a generative phase with these scenarios, right? So these scenarios, I think I used as tests at different points along the process when I was creating the syllabus. Mm-hmm. And, but early on, they caused me to go, what if, and how do I address that and generate probably way too many ideas. if I said, now I have to fit all these. No, so there you go. That's the course. Now, you know, shuffle, fit into, you know, 11 to 12 days. Yeah. Cause what's funny is, so they helped me generate ideas. Then they helped me prioritize and prune the ideas. And, then I tried to look at, once I had sort of a working rough prototype of, okay, here's a sequence that I think will work. Here's what I want to have happen as far as the day-to-day experience of every time we're in class. What's that? What do I want that to be like? And then what do I want the overall outcome to be like? Anyway.
So you work from outcome back in to activity.
In and out, back and forth.
Back and forth.
Yep. I try to work at different levels of granularity because in this case, it's a series. So it's a lot like planning any kind of serial entertainment. It's not just one installment. It's actually 11.
And it's 11 installments that can be reconfigured to a whole bunch of different sequences of events. And I think that your ability to do this can only come out of the fact that you can simultaneously see the connective narrative thread through it all while simultaneously seeing each piece as an individual piece, right? So seeing it, like going back to mind mapping, when we talked about mind mapping a couple episodes ago, and when you mm-hmm. have a mind map, you have like a singular idea or like a core sort of big idea, and then you branch out to all of the subsequent or supporting or divergent ideas that support the big idea at the center, right? And this can be a tree or it can be a line or it can be like the Karate Kid scoreboard kind of thing too. Had to mention Karate Kid. But... No, but I think it's important to point out. I mean, like, so I think like my ability as a teacher kind of like I felt it as a thing the moment I was able to compartmentalize all the different parts of the process without truly compartmentalizing them, right? It's like I put partitions around them and said, okay, this is all we're going to worry about today, but should somebody ask a really interesting question about this part that's in a partition over here, I can let them go into that area and that's no problem because it's all ultimately connected. It's all, these are all just crests of the ocean kind of thing.
Now, are you saying that as far as the planning aspect of when you're delivering a class, or are you saying as far as being in the performing
phase? I mean both. I mean, I start out with, it all comes back to that story I've told a million times. Like when I did my first syllabus and my teaching friend Mary Jo looked over it and said, "This is great. You know, you're not sticking to this, right?" And I was terrified thinking that, oh God, she's going to throw out, this is a 10-week course I've designed. I spent a long time on this. But what she really meant was you're going to be taking three parts out of this and two parts out of that, and that's going to be a whole new unit. And then you're going to take two parts out of this and six parts out of that, and that's going to be a whole new unit. It's all still the same stuff, but you're just going to have to reorganize it on the fly as you go. So I start out with an intention of a sequence, knowing that it's probably not going to go there. And I'm going to be delighted to find out where it really goes. But I've structured it in some kind of logical manner. Stories do this too, right? I mean, when you think about a story has a linear progression of events that happen. First he did this, then he did that, then he did this. And then you talk about hooks. What's the hook? How do you hook your audience? The hook traditionally means what is the beginning moment of your story that invites the readers to say, what happens next? And so in the case of my graphic novel, The Front, which I haven't mentioned in a while. I feel like I can do this now and get away with it. I started with the hero being perched on the top of a Ferris wheel that is being shaken to pieces by an abominable snowman and falling to his death. And then said, oh, wait, let me back up and let me start at the beginning, right? So I started with the hook, what happens next? So now you're hopefully on board to get through all of the tedious character introduction sequence that has to happen in a story. That's my friend Gibson. That's my friend Knox, and so on, right?
It's honestly a lot of learning and motivation has to do with having some incentive to go through the pain to get the benefit.
Yeah, actually.
And yeah, and a hook performs that need. And I mean, so a lot of times when we're this is a great argument for that logical approach, because let's say you didn't start the story that way. Let's say you started the story just however you felt like, because you have had a hard time finishing and publishing things and sharing your results publicly, like someone like me. let's just stop the...
That's right. What made the joke work, by the way, just to deconstruct your joke, was that we knew you were talking about you, and then you did the cough, which made us realize, yeah, we know you're talking about you, and then, like Bob Newhart, you come in at the end and say, like me.
You got to do the Bob Hart, well, the guy was, well, that was me.
And blink really hard when you do it. Anyway, there, but yeah, go. So you could start anywhere because you have trouble finishing projects.
And then you have the chance of, and not that this is the end of the world. Here's where you can start dealing with trade-offs, where maybe you deliberately say, like, no, I'm managing this other risk of, like, I need to proceed on this project and I'm stuck and spinning my wheels. So in order to defeat that aspect of not delivering, I'm going to create a risk regarding having the great hook aspect of getting the story going, right? Knowing that, well, more, and just go with my gut. Like, I'm just going to start with whatever comes out. Whereas here's a benefit of having a desired quality or aspect of the result, saying like, no, we've got to pull people into the story and got to, you know, build some momentum right at the beginning. And there you go. Like, I know everyone's probably already following along. I like to really emphasize certain points or whatnot. I mean, because we throw out different analogies and we, you know, fly through sometimes very abstract, and I don't know. It's worth pointing that out. Like, that's an example of one of those qualities, mm-hmm. saying, Yeah, you know what? I am going to make sure I check that off the list. This hook has to be, this has to be right.
Oh, of course, of course. And even on silly, dumb things like the Cat and Cat comic, there was some of that kind of thought going on. There was some of that kind of deliberate, how does this service the audience? What can I do to serve? So, for instance, when we first conceived of the idea of the comic, and I got a copy right here, everybody. Oh, by the way, you know...
Was that always in your hand or up your sleeve?
Yes. No, I got a stack here right next to my desk because I'm running an Etsy sale. And I got my last 20 copies are on sale on Etsy. That's at tinyastronaut.etsy.com if anybody's interested. But I'm not going to print anymore for a while because I'm not going to have access or not have time to do any screen printing for a little while. So that's it. They're gone. But I got the stack sitting right there is the reason I have it. I'm not that much of a huckster, Rob.
But, oh, no, I'm just being silly. But, I think it rocks because it just, boom, it's there. It's like his prop. That's it. Whoop.
All right, so.
All right, so Captain Cat, and you use this kind of thinking to work through something that came up.
The moment we said Captain Cat, former shark hunter, I instantly thought, well, you know what would be really eye-grabbing is a mini-comic. When you could take a mini-comic, it often opens to the center spread very naturally because it's a short book. You know, it's saddle stitched. Mini comics just tend to open right to the center spread. So I thought, well, all things notwithstanding, I don't know what the story is going to be yet. We're going to figure this out on the fly. But I know that in the center of that book is going to be a shark jumping over the boat. I had that image in my head. And this goes back to something Tom Sito, the animation director, worked for Filmation. He worked for Disney. He's doing, I think one of the most recent things I heard that he was doing was the Car Talk TV show, the cartoon that I think ran one season. But anyway, one of the things he said that really stuck with me is he said, when you think of the story of Moby Dick, you don't think of Call Me Ishmael. One day when I was feeling so-and-so, I went down to the sea. You think of Captain Ahab stabbing the heck out of that whale. You have a very visceral visual in your head when you think of that story. And I thought, well, this is the one for Captain Cat. That's the hook. The hook is when it opens to the center spread, you see a shark jumping over a boat and cats leaping dynamically out of the way. Boom. That's enough. And when I was tabling at the show, I had the books like this in a stand and just cover out. And, there was a good number of people who were like, oh, Captain Cat, former shark hunter, awesome. But then halfway through the first day, I opened up one copy and laid it down in front of the stand with the center spread, and there was a dramatic uptake in sales because of that hook. So, yeah, so even on a silly, casual project like that, this kind of thinking of what activity will service the audience needs. So, okay, let's define these real quick, Rob, because, I mean, we're saying these things cool. Like audience needs and activity and outcomes. Believe it or not, I've been present at some meetings where somebody talks about outcomes and there are people who don't know what that means. So I think it's worth defining this just in case. What do you mean when you say audience needs, Rob?
Let's see. A lot of times I mean my own emotional assumption based on what... No. I'm a clown today, I guess. Like a really tired, tired clown.
He's like Soupy Sales.
Exactly. Okay. So an audience needs, it's so deceptively simple, but incredibly powerful to say, whatever I'm assuming is good, I'm going to verify by this other perspective. Now, in order to verify from this other perspective, I got to quantify it somehow. What does that mean? Who in the audience? What do they care about? And then depending on how complete you want to go about it, I mean, you can go really deep depending on the kind of thing you're developing, right? You can go into when are they going to use this? How, what's the context like? What kind of, what's their, you know, and go into demographic stuff, you know, what's their income level, their, you know, where they live, all that kind of stuff. And that can be legitimate depending on the kind of product you're working on. And it all fits and it's scalable. So if you don't need all that detail, don't worry about it. And get enough of that perspective until you can say, oh, okay, I get who I'm targeting. I get how I can verify who I'm targeting. All right, cool. You probably did enough to say that's an audience and that's their needs. And somehow meeting those needs is that accomplishes your... being able to meet those needs means you've set up yourself to deliver a service.
In other words, selling out.
Exactly. And you do whatever you have to do. You redefine it. Principles? What principles? You know what? If someone says, hey, I make these kind of shoes and I'll give you a free slice of pizza if you put this shoe in every page of your book and compromise that story, because now it's shoe-based, not user-centric. Anyway, right. You do right. It. No, well, yeah, exactly. So the defense to that is your goals.
Right.
Which, so what's this outcomes work, Jersey?
Oh, outcomes.
I've had this meeting for how long and you've been talking about outcomes.
Yeah, outcomes. What is the, how does the behavior change upon interacting with the thing that you've made? What is the response that you want to the thing? And I don't mean response in terms of applause. I mean, how do you want to change the audience's perception, level of intelligence, their emotional state? Do you want to make them sad? Do you want to make them happy? Do you want to scare them? Do you want to thrill them? Do you want to delight them? If you say delight, you better be specific about what you mean by delight, because some people are delighted by the movie Saw, right? And some people are delighted by, Mystic Pizza. So It all depends. You have to be specific about the audience that you're trying to delight and how you're trying to delight them. Or are you trying to challenge
them? I've seen neither of those movies, by the way, just so you know.
I've seen Mystic Pizza.
Okay. I was always curious about it, but never got around to it.
Yep. You can live without it. It's all right. But anyway, this is where specifics come in. And, you know, like a thinking exercise I propose to my adult classes is think about your target audience. Think about your target audience as the person you would most likely be able to endure a weekend alone in a cabin with and not lose your mind, right? And really think hard about what would their qualities be. And that's where you start to visualize and project what your target audience is, and that's the person you're trying to serve. It's it's an extension of your values and what you, you know, cherish and hold dear in what you're trying to express through your work. So in a way, you're designing a participant for your expression and being specific about what you want your expression to do to them, not to limit yourself necessarily, but to come up with a definition that is easy to refer to when you don't know if you're headed in the right path, right?
And you're giving me I'm recollecting something that I don't know if I've read it or if I heard you say it, but like regarding like thinking about characters in the context of outcomes is an outcome is like, what kind of change do you want to have happen in the world? What kind of change do you want to have happen to the you and the readers? Like that's the outcome.
Yeah. And you're right. This not only works on the meta level of the project itself, but it can also work on the internal level of story logic of, you know, this is just like community college writing class kind of stuff where you say, you know, what changes do you want to have occur to your characters? What change happens in the world, if any, right? Do your characters change or not? You know, it could be that the outcome is that the characters don't change, but they have a pleasant diversion for a while. Or the readers don't change, but they have a pleasant diversion for a while, right? You don't necessarily have to be set out to set the world on its head. But I would submit that even making somebody laugh for a little while does cause some kind of a change. But yeah, you know, it's something we've talked about in past shows. And I think this is in our workshop pick of the week. We talk about this a little bit is the theme of your story. The way I like to think about it is I like to come up with a central argument. My theme is an argument. The Vietnam War was not justified. You know, I'm not saying that I feel one way or the other about that. I'm just saying, like, taking something that is a contentious issue, right?
Good God, y'all.
Right. And then line up these characters who feel one way about it and these characters who feel another way about it. And some of them are friends. Some of them are enemies. Watch them interact. Watch them not even necessarily debate the issue directly, but watch their positions cause friction between one another, which causes good character interaction. I've talked endlessly about the show Beast Wars. And one of the headline of that series, and it's on Netflix for those who are in North America and can use Netflix. It's the whole, all three seasons are on there. One of the great things they did with that show as a story-generating mechanism was they did the Gilligan's Island thing. They stranded them on a planet that may or may not be Earth. There's only six good guys, six bad guys. Put cats in a sack. Shake them up. Watch what happens. All the characters dislike each other in some way, a little bit, but they all respect each other in some way, a little bit. And it's fun watching those tensions rise as you watch characters like Optimus, who is very dedicated and he knows what the stakes are, but he hasn't revealed all the stakes to his troops. Rat Trap's a big coward and self-serving and irresponsible. Watching those two go at it is great. Rat Trap and Dinobot. Dinobot is the stalwart, honorable former villain. He's the anti-hero who has done the face heel turn. Where he's become a begrudgingly good guy with some bad guy tendencies, but deep down he's got this strong sense of honor, and he often gets partnered with Rat Trap, who's a complete sleazeball who will use any methods to achieve his goals because ultimately it's all about just getting his butt out of the fire as fast as he can. You can imagine what kind of tension you get out of those two characters, and it was a joy to watch. So you can also think of your outcome as being, okay, what do I want to do to my, what do I want to have happen in my story? What do I want to do to my audience? And the activity is, what's the plot of my story? Or the activity is, what, I mean, now we can get back to the meta sense. Activity could even be, what tools do I use for this outcome? Knowing what my outcome is, here's a good case in point. And I'm sorry, Rob, I'm talking like crazy. I didn't think I would, but I'm talking like crazy. SugaryCereals.com. Comic site intended to feel like Saturday morning cartoons of the 80s without directly referring to that, right? Something that new kids could glom onto and enjoy because thematically and stylistically, I was trying to lift everything that worked about 80s Saturday morning cartoons and infuse them into a new project, right? Without saying, like, it's retro, kids. You can find our shirts at Hot Topic. And one of the rules that I established with that project from the start was the comic has to be in color. Why? Because our audience is 12-year-old kids who enjoy the kind of cartoons that one might see on Saturday mornings 20, 30 years ago. Those kids are not necessarily going to grasp onto a comic that is rendered in black and white. That doesn't serve that audience needs. That audience needs bright, colorful, bold, vibrant entertainment, right? So again, knowing what your audience needs are helps inform your activities in order to get you to your desired outcomes. Did I say things?
Honestly, what's interesting about this is that this kind of reminds me a little bit of the thing that you dubbed my coat of arms a little bit. I mean, I guess my coat of arms is a way to generate the it's a project generator, I guess. Because considering audience needs. So let's see, I want to build or I want to do what I love. And I know you can pick on that statement or whatever, but do what I love, I guess, is assumed in this whole list. But then serving a community I care about. So thinking about the audience needs, using tools and methods I believe in. The do what I love is maybe that's the activity. Audience needs to engage in a sustainable trade. Do what I love using community I care about, using tools and methods I believe in to engage in a sustainable trade. Not a one-to-one list of.
And it's a little bit more abstract, but I think that it works because it's an internal coat of arms. This is not you working with a team, right? You couldn't put that on a plaque.
No. And I'm not saying it holds up it's a strong list. I mean, so what do we have so far? We've got audience needs. We've got, we talked about outcomes and then the activity and then, which I think there's a lot to the activity, like you said, but, I mean, cause it's really the, you know, thinking of the, like I began Art Geek Zoo knowing I wanted to at some point do something interactive with this. Not that I was able to fully establish that as criteria in a way that I think I pulled off, but I knew that I wanted to discover that. And I guess I did over time. I discovered that by continuing to produce it and refine it. to then find the version of the characters that would work in a game context.
Oh, that's something we should put in here as a underline in black crayon thing, is this can be iterative too. This is not something where you have it pre-designed and fully formed at the outset, right? Mm-hmm. This is something where you can go in with and this should be adaptable and mutable in order to address things as they come along. Address changes in the audience behavior, changes in your outlook on the project after participating in it and so on. What I also want to say is in the show notes, let's put your coat of arms in there, because I want to throw out another challenge to the Lean Into Art listeners. Is design Rob a coat of arms based on his coat of arms.
Cool.
I don't know what the winner will get, but whoever turns in it will get used on the site somehow. With link credit to the person who created it.
Yeah. At the very least.
But I want to get to some of the on the ground stuff in a second here. So I'm closing thoughts. I'll start and then I'll give it over to you to close out the 1,000 feet up stuff. Is all I'm saying is that this is a framework that I think is adaptable and applicable to whenever you are choosing a new project, which one to do, which one you feel like. How do you determine whether it has legs if you can't figure that out for yourself? Like when I talked about the Captain Law, former shark hunter, I knew at least had enough legs for an 8-page mini comic. Does it have enough legs for a graphic novel? I don't know. That's where I'll refer to this kind of structure, just to give my brain a boost and dig into it a little bit more deeply. And then a lot of it is pacing in your office, just like all writing. A lot of it is pacing in your office and, letting that back of the brain do the crunching on it too. But I think that this kind of framework can be really useful for at least giving you a quick push in a direction to investigate.
Well, I mean, all I really have for that is, yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a foothold, but then how you apply that foothold over time, I think would be a good way to get into our on the ground.
Well, with that, I think it's time we go to ground, hit the ground, and talk about some of those various things that we can use. Like we talked about theory, we talked about, the big ideas behind this. Now it's time to talk about application. Just for a few minutes.
Yeah. Let's see. So applying that whole having some way to frame up a problem is super helpful. It's a model, right? And I think you can arrive at a model by the you can shop for it in the land of abstract and find it via a podcast like this one. Or you could shop for it by finding the thing that one of the triggers or examples of what you wish to build, right? So if you're into metal, what songs are inspiring you or what have you, and what about them? And so you start decomposing them and reacting to your decomposition of the thing. Deconstruct? I don't know. Software uses a lot of morbid words sometimes that are just in my unbox is reason. I like that. Yeah. That's neutral and cool. And you know what? I unbox lots of awesome things. Like things arrive, but from whatever provider.com. And I'm like,
people
all right.
People make videos of their unboxing their things that they get from Amazon. You know, it's like, yeah, it's a exactly. Cheerful experience. Like, oh, I'm unboxing it. So yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's like you're like the treasure chest animation in Zelda or something. Like Wind Waker.
That's right. Wind Waker had the best unboxing video.
Yeah, Link was mighty pleased with whatever the heck he pulled out of those any box. So, pretty awesome.
What do you got?
Yeah, it's funny how that whatever making fun of the vocab of that phrase. Another example of that, by the way, is the is a project postmortem, as if something's laying on. I mean, ew. I didn't make a corpse. Come on. I made some software and it's helping people. I don't want to be talking about something that died. Well, you know what died is, my summer, because I was working too many nights. Anyway, So excuse me for letting that out. I think I'm a little repressed. Getting to, you know, again, back to the practical stuff that you can, you know, there's different ways where I think you can start to apply those kind of, you can be very, deliberate through either an abstract process or by, you know, picking something that is an inspiration and then breaking that down. And I know that that's something you've brought up in the past in various podcasts where, yeah. And it's just a great, great learning approach to start thinking about, well, what stories do you like?
Yeah. That's an activity I do in every class that I teach with every new class of kids. I have them bring a comic or a book that they really enjoy. Well, actually, I really do try to restrict it to comics because we talk about art and writing. And I say, and it becomes an interview process where I say, what do you like about the book? The drawings. Okay. What do you like about the zoo? The animals. More specifically, what about the drawings? Show me one drawing that you really like in there. And then we start plumbing what it is about that book that's lit them on fire, that's made it their favorite. And that's a way to highlight, isolate, and shine a light on what's informing their tastes, where they want to go eventually, right? And so, okay, let's pick apart what that guy does. So you can start to use it for yourself, that vampirism again. So, yeah.
There's a chance now you've broken what was this immutable big problem into smaller problems.
Yep.
And so by having some kind of model to start tackling that project, you're able to not try to expect success out of just one giant finished deliverable, right? There's often that it's not always so. Sure, you may be familiar with a comic as a the progression of the process of finishing a page, but then how do you arrive at that whole story? If you haven't tackled that yet, you may be expecting, well, I'm supposed to have out of whole cloth, I've got to get this idea out of my head, instead of having some chance to chip away and iterate at it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I wondered if you had any thoughts on what tools you use, because I know you've talked many times in the past about how you and your wife do like a year, sort of like year in review, where you guys break out giant dry erase boards and throw ideas at, like, you know, reflecting on how the year went. And I would imagine that this kind of like objectives and outcomes thing comes into play, evaluating what your objectives were, what the outcomes that you had set upon, and what were the outcomes actually upon finishing the activity. I'm sure you use a lot of whiteboarding stuff, but is there anything else that you use to map out these kinds of to assess something in this way that we've described today?
So I mentioned scenarios before. And a scenario is it is like a box like that you get to put in the qualities of a desirable result. So my wife and I, when we're doing our yearly planning, you got to the rest of the circle. I mean, so obviously it begins with generating and then honing and refining and prioritizing ideas, because maybe we come up with too many things and that sounds fun over the course of 5 or 10 years, but I don't see how we could do that in 1 year, kind of thing. And then once we get to the, you know, given list, and we go about our year, and we use these, I think they're kind of fun. Like, I mean, it's just a post-it note, but it's huge. It's like a poster-sized post-it note.
Oh, okay. That's right. Yeah. The big, yeah. Big old sticker flip charts.
Yeah, exactly. And so depending on, you know, wherever we'll just stick them on the wall and you know, write on them. We typically stick one or two or like a couple deep, so we're pretty sure we're not going to write on the wall, that kind of thing. But after we get that down, we'll check the things off the list as we're getting them done. And then when the end of the year rolls around, we do it all over again. But then, of course, after our first year, we always have one to look back on, and we get to say, well, did we get to those outcomes that we were wanting? And I do have a For me, I have two ways of defining an outcome. An outcome can be essentially a threshold to cross, that it is a, once it is passed, it is passed. And then there's another one that is sort of a, and that's essentially a, I think of that as a traditional goal. Yeah, it's a traditional goal that you can reach by tasks. But then I have another flavor of that called just a way of being. And that is just that, that's something that's a little, it's, I guess in a way that's probably like a little mini project. It's like, am I able to embody that thing that I, that, that quality I wrote down, right? Because if I'm doing a fitness routine once a week versus once every 6 months or whatever, you know, I can't just check it off the list for the whole year that I did a fitness routine. It, the, what the intent of behind that goal is to say I'm actively engaged or living up to that thing.
Here we go. So in other words, correct me if I'm wrong here, Rob, but in other words, it's saying this year I'm committing to doing a warm-up sketch every day and putting it on my site for sale. There's two ways of looking at this outcome. A, I could say at the end of the year, I will have 365 original sketches that I've put up for sale, right? Mm-hmm. That's the one that's achievable by tasks. The other way of looking at it is I'm committing myself every day to engage in a creative act regardless of how I feel, right? Even if I'm feeling sick, even if I have a cold, even if I just got into a fight with my friend and I don't feel like drawing, I'm putting that time in at the desk every day. That's the way of being versus the threshold-oriented goals, right?
Yeah.
Summarize.
and for me, again, this, it's individual. Whatever works for you as far as how you define it. Once I came across that distinction, I was like, oh, okay. Now these goals and things feel more palatable to me. They just make more sense to me.
Yeah. They speak to different dispositions too, which I like.
So
I wonder if we should refer to our past episode on spreadsheeting, because I imagine that spreadsheeting would come into this a lot too.
Yeah, I agree. And so again, scenarios, right? So if let's say you're trying to figure out what is important, I will sometimes do a brainstorm in a spreadsheet as far as like what are some important things, and then I'll rank them. You can then put numbers by everything, and you could rate them on like the, you know, 1 to 5. You could rank them purely saying like there's a list of 100 things, and there's going to be 100 levels of priority or whatever. And that helps me sort and sift. And a spreadsheet is pretty awesome with that, because then you can say, show me only the ones that are 1 and above. Show me only ones that are, you know, show me sand the floor. Show me, you know, paint the fence.
That's two. So yeah. So that was the first thing I thought of when I thought of like, well, how would you organize this kind of stuff? And Ann and I are in the exact same place. You've been to my house. You've seen, we got dry erase boards and chalkboards all over the damn place to capture ideas and to discuss and measure these kinds of projects. And then when that fails, spreadsheet, right? And like you said, you can do sort orders on them really easily.
And one thing that's huge, I'm sorry to interrupt, as far as spreadsheeting, and you're trying to, is coming up with a, like a model for a week or something, like and how much time you have as a resource to tackle that thing, or as a matter of like, if it's dealing with finances and recurring, you know, some kind of recurring resource like that, you end up defining that recurring cycle and seeing like what's realistic to fit in this cycle. And I've gone through many phases where I'll be heavily into figuring out this is how many hours of sleep are in a week, and this is how many how many hours I put into engaging in a service to get money, and then this is how many hours, you know,
yeah,
family, friends, whatever. And yeah, that it gets wild, but it, and honestly, some of those are pretty throwaway efforts, but I do gain an insight that I use to help me with planning. So my purpose isn't to like try to say I'm coming up with so many crazy measures, watch me Houdini my way out of this trap that I could never succeed in making sure I got it all done.
It's a way of giving yourself an alternate or 1,000-foot up look at what you're actually doing and what you have as far as resources, so you don't get caught in that trap of where did all my time go again? how did I find myself in this situation again? Right. It's yeah.
So can I, I'm sorry. I just don't, I'm all fired up about spreadsheets. So one more thing about spreadsheets with scenarios is you have, so you have a list of qualities on the left column or wherever you want to put them. You can go across the top too. So you have a list of qualities and then you have a scenario as your heading columns, right? And then you can check off as far as which scenarios, are embodying which qualities. And then you can then weight the qualities to see which scenario yields the preference, or you might react to it and say, I don't know. I don't agree. And either way, you're shaking yourself out of whatever current perspective you have to gain new insight and
yeah,
move forward.
I couldn't agree more. Shaking you out of indecision, right? Nothing's worse. Nothing's worse than indecision, I should say. So I had a resource that I wanted to point people at too. As I was, you know, thinking through these notes for this episode, I was reminded of Comics Are Great, episode 10. I had a talk with Luis Escobar of luisescobarsblog.com, Simpsons storyboard artist and animator. And he was really, at the time, fired up about the Dramatica application for story building, which is very similar to what we were talking about today in this way of like really breaking down what are the outcomes and goals that we're trying to achieve and how do we line up our resources to create activities to achieve those outcomes for the audience that we're trying to serve. And Dramatica, if you haven't heard of it, it is a piece of software, but it's also a book. You can just use it as a book. There's a free audio book that you can get, and the links are in the resources on Comics Are Great episode 10, which I'll link to in the show notes. It's at comicsaregreat.com. You can also just search for Luis Escobar on the search bar.
Is one way to summarize what Dramatica is it's part project management system totally focused on storytelling, part content management system.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. Which, when you think about it and you see it in action, it's like, whoa, wait, I don't like this idea of Mad Libs writing. But as Luis makes a pretty compelling case for in the episode that I refer to, it's not about filling in the blanks for you. It's more or less trying to structure the writing process with really good questions to ask you. And your answer is the act of writing, right? And I know that I have said before that when I'm doing my books from time to time, if I'm stuck on an idea, I'll have a conversation with myself and I'll ask myself questions about the story. And my answering of those questions is the mining of the data that I need to tell the story. So that's the way I like to think about Dramatica, although I totally understand why some writers and some creative types would be repelled by this idea. But if you found this discussion interesting, there's more to be had there. And plus, Luis is a really smart guy that I don't get to talk to enough. So
I remember that episode. It was awesome.
Do you have any other book recommendations? Food for thought blog posts?
One thing that this reminds me of is two really important. And I know I get in modes where I start really worshiping certain aspects of the creative process.
Yeah, Rob, are you still there? Oh, did I lose you? Rob Stenzinger, will you please sign in?
Huh.
Oh, there you are. Still there?
All right, here we go.
Getting some bandwidth issues.
Should I try that again?
Yes. So one of the things you tend to worship certain parts of the creative process.
And lately, it's this distinction between when is really a good time to be in a generating ideas mode, and then when is a good time to be into refining and focusing those ideas, and then versus then when is a good time to be then just rocking forward with these ideas, and it's kind of like you can divide it into more sections than that, but those three seem to be helping me a lot lately in like meetings day to day, saying, okay, which phase are we in right now? And let's do activities that are best serving that phase to get the right outcome so we can move on. So, and the book for that, sorry for the long walk, Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg.
Captured for the show notes.
And I mean, especially the audiobook, she is a pleasure to listen to. She's just a very wise and experienced writer who does a great job of respecting the pain and challenge that many times many of us face in our creative projects, gently accepting that, but providing strategies to work through it and to observe these critiquing mind is too darn talkative and stopping you from progressing, you know, getting practiced at just letting it out and, you know,
yeah,
expressing.
Well, adding it to my Audible. Our bandwidth is going really, it's getting really bad. So we should be wrapping up pretty soon anyway. Yeah. You're coming in super choppy. I don't know how I'm coming in on your end, but I think we can call this one good as far as we can call this one discussed for this week. And with that, I think we can move on to takeaways. And we'll end on a high note. So, Rob, did anything happen to you this week that was worth bringing for takeaways? Things that you reflected on and said, I'm a different man now?
The experience of teaching, I highly recommend it. I think anyone who is an artist that has applied themselves to gain a certain skill, that means you have an asset that's worth sharing and practicing sharing it in some way or another, because I keep learning more and more by seeking to share what I'm learning, even if it's as I'm learning it. And is the case in, for instance, the web design class. Yeah. A lot of it's old knowledge, but it's so ever evolving and changing too. There's plenty of new stuff in there, and it's, and just the experience of teaching, I highly recommend, you don't have to be appointed. You can appoint yourself and just share the stuff in a blog and whatnot. And I got a late curveball for you, but we don't have to do it right now. How did you appoint yourself to do podcasting?
Oh man, I told this story 100 times, man. This is an easy one. I appointed myself because I found the landscape of the medium lacking something that I was desperately craving. It started with me and Mark Rudolph and my buddy Hoover having phone conversations about storytelling and the things that drove me spiritually crazy. And I would go on a tirade, or they would go on a tirade about something, and then we'd breathlessly be like, oh, that was cathartic. That felt good to get that out. And then it was always followed up with, why am I not hearing this on the comics podcast that I love or that I listen to? Mm-hmm. Not that I'm loving them. I'm listening to them and wondering, when are they going to get to that part of the conversation that I want? So it was a situation where I saw the need and I just wanted to address it, even if nobody listened to it. It was purely, well, worst case scenario, it's a catharsis for me once a week. And that came out of me finding myself teaching. I appointed myself a teacher because I needed a job. And I'm not going to say that because my freelance work dried up for a while. I had a really bad couple of years. I mean, really bad financially. And I was working a part-time job to, you know, make ends meet. And the opportunity came along to do some teaching and comics in classrooms. And I thought, well, gee, then at least that's like sticking with what I love to talk about. I can do that. And I'm not going to say that I was all that good at it when I started. But in doing it, it irrevocably changed the way I looked at my medium. It changed the way I think about comics, because I had to go back and ask myself, what am I doing when I'm sitting at the page, right? I didn't just crack open How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way and say, do this, kids. You know, I sat down and said, let's design something brand new. And I asked myself, what would you most want to know, Jers, if you were a kid trying to pick up the pencil for the first time? You know, that's a tough question. So, yeah. But, yeah, you know, it's like I was going to make a joke before you asked that curveball. Is that here I am listening. I got my earbuds and I'm listening to Lean Into Art. And I'm going, man, I should give this show 5 stars on iTunes because it's a great show. But then after I'm done thinking that, I think, well, that's all well and good for Rob because he has been anointed or appointed or whatever word you want to use by other powers that be. Somebody let him do it. somebody gave him permission to go and do that thing. And besides, Rob's good at it. He's always been good at it. He got up this. He got up, you know, when he was 11 years old, and said, "Hey, I'm good at this teaching gig. Of course, I'm going to do it someday." He has credentials. He has all the credentials in the world. Look at all those ribbons. It's like the Wizard of Oz, where the wizard says to the Scarecrow, "It's like, well, here's a diploma, kid. Now you got brains."
That's most like it, actually. And you're the wizard, by the way, Jersey.
No, but yeah, no, I think you're right, though. I think that, you know, it's not something where we have to wait for permission to do it.
Yeah, it's you can't go through that process without transforming your understanding of what you're working on and or your relationship to then also sharing it and how that feels to do so. Anyway, yeah. I recommend it.
I'm glad you're having a good time doing it, Rob. I knew you would, but I'm also just glad that you're having a good time doing it, because I knew that was a threshold you had on your yearly plan, and I'm glad that you met it, and it's fun.
That was on the post-it note. I had no idea how it was going to happen. lastly, I have an observation that somewhere in that community related to FAIR and MCAT or whatnot, someone is being a benefactor and or an advocate, because I went from having 2 students signed up to 7 students signed up to 18 students, over 18 actually students signed up. Wow. And I'm like, what? Anyway, so yeah, and then basically, and I found that out on my way up to teach the class.
Awesome.
I was going to go teach 7. It was awesome surprise. What a super, super awesome surprise. And I have no idea how that happens from a Friday to a Monday without someone was cheerleading regarding that class. And I'm just, I appreciate it. So that's a takeaway.
So well, cool. Well, and see, this is how it works. Those 18 kids are going to take your class. They're going to love it. They're going to tell their friends next term. You're going to have a full class again, possibly more than a full class, you know. That's how it begins. It begins with, you know, like at least, you know, let's say 10% of the class, 10%. So what would that be? 1.8 kids, 2 kids, round up. They go and tell a couple of their friends about, yeah, I took this awesome HTML class. Or they start doing something with the stuff they learned in your class. I learned this great UI design stuff. Where'd you learn how to do that? Oh, I took this really awesome class. Boom, there's a couple new kids that you're going to expect next year.
Cool.
Because you're going to put pour your guts into it, and the kids are going to have a good time, and they're going to learn a lot, you know? So.
Cool, I hope so. And I'm absolutely pouring my guts into it, so. Yes. Anyway, how about you, Jersey? What kind of takeaways you have for your week?
I don't know if I want to save my takeaway for next week as the curveball, because I think it's easily 15 minutes worth of talking about. I can do a tease for it, but I learned that in some cases, downgrading is a preferable road to take in our gadget lust-filled society, where the new shiny thing is always, always better. I found myself saying that, you know what? I'm going to take 3 steps back, because it turns out, and I'm not as a reaction, not as hey, you hipsters, to heck with you, I'm going to go do X in reaction to you. It was more of looking at the facts, looking at all the stuff on paper going, you know what? That is nice, all those new things, but I can do the same amount of stuff, possibly more with less. So I'm not turning.
And I got to say, Jersey, this podcast sounds pretty good over Crystal Radio.
We should try to do it over ham radio. I gotta get my ham license so we can broadcast that way. But anyway, yeah, that'd be interactive. But anyway, but yeah, I'll save that for next time.
Or we can do CBs.
You have to observe those FCC rules. You wouldn't be able to curse anymore, Rob. But closing, we're going to be places. One more reminder about October 6th. Rob is going to be at FallCon, MidwestComicBook.com. Yes?
Yes, sir. And coming up mighty fast. I'll be tabling there. Can't wait. Jersey, you're going to be at the Detroit Fan Fair October 26th and 28th.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that right?
DetroitFanFair.com.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm going to be there on behalf of Kids Read Comics, so I'm not going to be there tabling my own stuff. I'm going to be there leading workshops and then also doing sketches. And if you want to come by and get a sketch and maybe drop a buck in the bucket to raise money for KRC 2013, that'd be awesome. But that's going to be in Detroit, Michigan, October 26th through 28th. And then we got our workshop pick of the week. If you thought this discussion was interesting, if you thought this stuff had a lot of meat that you wish we would have gone into more detail on, oh, man, I've got 4 hours of content on leanintoart.com/workshops, and that is our workshop pick of the week, Comics Fundamentals, a four-part series that I led for 30 classes in 30 days, which goes through a very structured discussion of all of the various realms of concern one can confront when making a comic or graphic novel, from world building to character design to setting up themes and having your characters argue over the themes. It's a rich 4 hours, and you can get it at leanintoart.com/workshops. It'll be linked to in the show notes. That's for the people who are really signed on and really enjoy the show and want more. That'd be a great way to support the show, give Rob and me a pat in the back for putting the show together every week. Or if you don't want to pop for a paid workshop, a great free way to help the show out would be to either give this video on YouTube a thumbs up, or you could go to iTunes and give us a star review. You don't even have to write a review. You can just give us a star review to let people know. It helps raise our visibility to let other people know that this thing exists. And if you think there are other people out there like you who would enjoy this kind of thing, you could let them know by just simply giving us a star review. By the way, I checked recently. We got a whole bunch of star reviews from listeners. Thank you guys very much for doing that. We really appreciate it. We are watching. So
that's awesome. Thank you.
So, yeah, I guess that's it, Rob.
Yeah, Jersey. What? So I don't. We navigated another one.
We did it again. So we'll be back again in 1 week, Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern time, or approximately 9 p.m. Eastern time. We send out a notification on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus when we do it. So just keep your eyes on there. And until the next time we do a show, I have been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.